Welcome back, everybody. Well, I hope you had some nice refreshments and edibles out there. Before we get going, I do want to say a couple quick thank yous. There's a lot of thank yous to offer tonight, but we'll start with thanking the Viroqua Masonic Lodge for letting us use this space. It's a unique and interesting space. It's fun to be in here, I think we all agree. A lot of steps and a lot of coat hooks out there. Seriously, do you see all those hooks? It's crazy. And the second thank you to WDRT and these awesome youth initiative students over here helping with the sound and the lights and all that. Thank you, guys. So more thank yous to come. But let's get this rolling. Our first storyteller here after intermission is a youth initiative student who just realized how many people he's talking in front of. I just realized that. And is probably looking for an exit. You'll see exits over here. Get ready for an old family legend that is a journey both literally and figuratively. The title of his story is called The Red Thread. Please welcome Max Moon.
All right. A couple things you should know about me before I get started. I'm feeling a little bit sick right now, so I apologize if my voice isn't the best. And I'm an introvert, so I'm terrified right now. Thank you. Okay, so the story I'm about to tell isn't actually mine. It's over 100 years old. It's been passed down through my family for generations. It was not the easiest to like track together. I talked to my dad. He told me to talk to my grandma. I talked to her. And eventually I was put in touch with a distant cousin, and I landed on the story I'm about to tell you today. It's a story about adventure. It's a story about hardship. And ultimately, it's a story about love. We start in the late 1800s in a small town in Switzerland called Bonningen. At the time, this town was very poor. And this was where my great-great-grandfather Rudolph was born. His family, like most families there, was, like I said, very poor, and he used to play with all of the other kids, right? In particular, one kid, a couple years younger than him, a girl named Elizabeth. You might want to remember her for later. As he grew up, he sort of began to realize that he couldn't stay in Bonningen. He looked around, and there wasn't much opportunity for him, and he began to hear stories about America, and one place in particular, called the Gallatin Valley, really caught his interest. It had rolling hills and immense forests, just like the home he loved so much. So when he was 20, he waved his family goodbye and made the two-month journey from Switzerland to America. As soon as he got there, he headed straight to the Gallatin Valley and a small town there. He found a pretty big community of German and Dutch, which was actually great because he didn't speak any English at all. He looked around, he saw farmers were doing very well there, but he didn't want that life for himself. He was really only interested in one thing, making liquor. A wealthy German family bankrolled him, and soon the Tivoli bar was up and running. Apparently, he was also a little bit of a loan shark. Records in his will showed hundreds of pages of people that owed him pretty detailed amounts of money, and there's also a couple of stories that the bar had some gambling going on that apparently was pretty lucrative, so quite the mischievous man. Business was booming. He brought his four younger brothers over from Switzerland. They helped with the bar and eventually put down roots, settled, started making connections, families. And at this point, great-great-grandpa Rudolph had almost everything he wanted. He had family, he had friends, he had money, but he was missing one really important thing, and that was love. He would find the solution to his problem very unexpectedly on a trip back to Switzerland. It was one of the only trips he would make, and while he was there, he was talking with family, talking with old friends, and he heard mention of that girl, Elizabeth, from earlier, and that she had moved to America and was working for a very, very wealthy family in New York. This really excited him because none of the women back home spoke his language, and those who did, he really didn't have any interest in. So as soon as he got back home, he started writing her letters. The two talked for years this way, and they really hit it off. Once he even made the journey all the way across the country to come and visit her, he knew what he wanted at this point. Rudolph waited for a little while, and after debating it inside his head for a bit, he sent a letter asking her to marry him. Her response was simple. She knew that she loved him, but she really only had one question, and that was, where would she live? He responded to this by building her a house. They were happy. Everything was going great. They arranged for their families to meet with them in San Francisco, which at the time was the easiest place to get by boat from Switzerland. But something happened that would make Elizabeth's departure from New York much, much earlier than expected. This is where the family records sort of get murky. Nobody knows what happened, but the conditions that Elizabeth had were worsening. There was tell that the family was mistreating her. Some say she was even physically abused by them, but something happened, one big culminating event, one big thing that caused her to leave. There's even stories that involved the murder. She made her way down by train to Panama and then up to San Francisco, which is the fastest way to get there. And I can only imagine how scared and just not knowing what she would have, what was to do, how she would have felt. I mean, she didn't have any way to get in contact with Rudolph at the time. So once she was in San Francisco, she was lucky enough to find an old German lady, and she stayed with her until Rudolph and both of their families could arrive. And finally, that invisible thread, the red thread crossing across the whole map, could finally bring them together, and with both of their families present, they tied the knot. They moved back home to the house that Rudolph had built her, and 11 months later, their first child, Henry, was born. I'm going to let you guys do the math on that one. Henry was my great-grandfather. As time went on, they had two more kids, John Lewis, who everybody just called Louis, and Marguerite. Business went on, but Rudolph started hearing rumors of something called the Prohibition, and he knew what this was going to mean for his bar. He decided to invest in a ranch that him and his wife could retire to once the kids were out of the house, and he didn't need to run the business anymore. He brought over a young man from Switzerland named Fred Body to run and take care of the ranch while he was still in town working, taking care of his kids. But unfortunately, Rudolph would never see the day that he could retire to this ranch. In 1915, he died due to complications with his arthritis. This loss understandably shook the family. Henry, his oldest child, was only 16 at the time, and since Elizabeth, his wife, was a woman, and women couldn't own businesses back then, she was forced to sell the bar. She lived off the money that he left her and the money from this bar for a while as her children started growing up and having adventures of their own. Marguerite, her daughter, married a German man. Louis stayed home and took care of her. And great-grandpa Henry went off and became a pretty successful engineer. Rumor has it he may have even worked on the Manhattan Project. But don't tell anyone I told you that. He would send back money every single week to his aging mother, and even after she died, he continued to help and support his family. Henry only had one daughter, and her name was Margaret. Margaret had a son. His name was Michael. And Michael had a son, too. And that son has just finished telling you his story.
Our next storyteller, when I find my place, prefers to tell stories to students under the age of adulthood. That's us. But also likes a good challenge, which is why she has found herself here tonight. The title of her story is called Straw into Gold. Please welcome Beth Krieger-Fritch.
I stared down the hill, steep, frozen with icy snow. I watched as my siblings gathered around the periphery. The hill was thick with trees, and if you looked carefully enough, you might notice a subtle trail. That's where we were gonna sled down. We had already named it Double Daredevil Hill, so we had to do it. I heard the footsteps of my brother Mark gaining speed behind me. Yahoo! He called as he sailed through the air, face first, as if on a magic carpet, winding his way deftly through the trees, somehow making it unscathed. Next was my sister Helen, who dutifully and somehow completely independently from Mark sailed down after him. Steve, my oldest brother, was finding the most dangerous route that he could and took that hill kamikaze style. My youngest brother, in his two big hand-me-down moon boots, trudged melancholically through the snow, his cheeks giving off the impression that he was pouting, but really they were so big and thick and round and wonderful, we just teased him. We knew he was deep in contemplation. My oldest sister, Mona, watched from the top of the hill and wisely allowed what was happening. It was dark. The only light was moonshine glinting off the snow. I wiped the trail of snot that was running from my nose into my mouth like a warm, sad waterfall. I gathered my strength, holding on to the sled. And with a little running start, I took off head first into the darkness. With my siblings, I could do anything. There were six of us growing up. I was the fifth one. So if you're a middle child, what that means is I was the middle of the middle children, which what that means is I was an excellent observer of everyone's trials and triumphs. And I stood back and I watched what worked and what didn't work, and I took notes, and I paused for a little bit longer, and then I decided what I was going to do. This worked. But it led me to feel sometimes a little bit on the outside. I was also melancholic, and so I felt that way no matter what. And watching all the things my siblings did and me taking a step back, looking at their brilliance and their bravery, I wondered, would I be able to do the same things? My parents kept that theme of being a little bit different for us alive. In 1984, it was not legal to homeschool in Wisconsin, and that year they passed a law making it legal, so the next year we started doing that. The UPS man would come, and five of us would meet him at the door, dressed up as G.I. Joe and gymnasts and wandering nomads, and he would give us sideways looks, but we'd say, "We go to homeschool." He'd leave the package and be on his way. It was okay to feel different. When you feel different, you kind of fill yourself up with, what is that? A sense of yourself, I guess. Maybe a little drop of what will be your future self, that individuality that isn't fully there yet when you're so deeply connected with your tribe. Well, this would continue our playground, on the hills and in the rivers. Whatever we couldn't do, Mark helped us find a way to do. There was a river. It was on someone else's land, but we found a way there. We didn't have a boat, but there was a junkyard next door and a fiberglass door, so we took that and tested the physics and buoyancy, and a flat-nosed prow of a boat works to go up and down a river, turns out. It wasn't all fun and games. My mother homeschooled us, and it was not the unschooling that sometimes you hear about. It was a rigorous schedule. Academics were immensely important to her. But so, too, was the cultivation of our spiritual life. And we did that differently as well. I was raised Roman Catholic, but instead of the acoustic guitar-playing churches that were much closer and in actual churches, we went to Marchese's dance hall, which we rented out Sunday morning after a wedding, had been there Saturday night, and were lulled into deep prayer and contemplation and sometimes sleep by the dead language of Latin all around us. But I truly did take in the sounds, the incense, the Gregorian chant, and I prayed devoutly for the health and safety of every family member. Almost compulsively, I wouldn't miss a single prayer. And then I would look up at the altar, which was where the bar had been rolled away an hour earlier, to see him. Jesse Batha, the altar boy whom I had the biggest crush on in the world. I looked up and I thought, this is a sad case of unrequited love. It's never going to work because he's dating my sister Helen. So as usual, I took a step back and I watched and I learned from their trials and tribulations and I took notes and I thought, I will figure out how to thread my way through this one day too. It wouldn't be long, because as I got older and passed through that middle childhood time period of life, in Waldorf circles we call it the 9-year change, but I'll spare you those details. I was somewhere between 8 and 11 years old, probably closer to 11, and we were at one of those Catholic family parties. It was Halloween. They were Catholic families, so there were hordes of people everywhere from every single age with casseroles cooking and jello molds and lots of diaper smells, and it was a wild scene around me. I tell you, it was Halloween, that time when the veil between the two worlds is so thin, between the conscious and unconscious, the living, the dead, the visible, the invisible. The whole scene became blurry in front of me. My ears plugged up and rang, and in that moment, one thread of my future self and another thread of my future self came inside of me. I looked to one side, and I thought, I have no choice. I have to become a nun. I need to serve the holy in my life. I need to transform what doesn't work into what can be beautiful. And at the same time, I knew I had a beloved out there somewhere in the world. Not like a mystic beloved of God, like a carnal man. I even felt the soft curve of our future baby heads in my arms. I held both of those completely opposing disparate parts, but they braided themselves inside of me, and I would never go back. My vision went into focus, my ears unplugged, and I went back to the older kids who were telling Yo Mama jokes, and I ate caramel corn. Soon, I would get to go to high school. No longer would I attend homeschool in the basement with my plastic dishpan of books, but instead, I would go to a brick and mortar school, and I was thrilled. Even though it was a small private high school, I was thrilled nonetheless, but I made a decision. That feeling of being a little separate and different from those around me had really solidified in me, and I thought, I'm going to be different than those who are here. I'm going to separate myself. I joined cross country, but I wore my grunge alternative clothes that came off the floor of my friend's basement. I said no to cigarettes, but I kept Kurt Cobain's suicide note tacked up in my locker. When all the girls in my class were talking about this boy who they thought was so cute, one of the sophomores, I said, Tommy Fritsch? I don't even think he's that cute. I was practiced at external antagonism. And I carried on that way and tried to find the most controversial relationships I could get myself involved in for years and years until it finally started to wear out inside of me just a little bit. This happens somewhere around your junior year. A restlessness. You need something different. I listened to Tupac's Changes soundtrack over and over and over again, and that's what I needed, some changes. So I decided to break up with my boyfriend of 3 years for the third and final time. And in my moment of darkness, I did what I often did. I returned to religion. My dearest friend, Marta, wanted to come with me to the Stations of the Cross at Holy Hill. It was Good Friday. She was from Spain and wanted this American experience. So I said, we can do that. So we went. And we watched as 10 robed men carried a gigantic cross down the aisle to the altar. And it was rumored that a shard of that cross from the original cross at Golgotha was inlaid in there so everyone could go to the front and touch it and have a feeling of that connection. We came home and we did what 17-year-olds do or 16-year-olds. I don't know, we painted our toenails or we gossiped or we were doing something and the phone rang and my mother answered it, Elizabeth, telephone! I pulled the long cord down from my parents' room into my bedroom and looked at the caller ID and it said Thomas Fritsch. Marta and I freaked out. What? It's Tommy Fritsch. What are we going to do? I don't know what to do. But in our practice way, I picked it up and I said, hello? A movie? Spaceballs? I thought you were dating Monica. Oh, you broke up yesterday? Okay. As usual, and as is still true to this day, I overscheduled myself the next day when we were supposed to meet for this date. I taught swimming lessons in the morning. I put on my denim button-up shirt for Country Kitchen, and I went to serve eggs and steak. And the second shift didn't show up, as also usually happened. This is not a time of cell phones or snapping or whatever, and I didn't have his phone number memorized, so I couldn't call him to say I might be a little bit late. So I raced through serving dishes quick as I could. I finally convinced the assistant cook to come out and hold the floor for me, and I raced home. My mother, who had no interest in any of my boyfriends before, threw me a washcloth. I washed my armpits off. I took some Bath & Body Works strawberry essence gel and ran it through my hair. I didn't want to appear too desperate, so I put an Adidas t-shirt on. And then, in my Pontiac Safari 1990 station wagon, I put the pedal to the metal. And I turned a 40-minute drive into 30 minutes, but I was 2 hours late for our meeting time. There's no way Tommy Fritsch is going to be there. I wouldn't be there. I would have left after half an hour. I would have said, what a jerk. That's what I thought. But when I pulled in, that familiar silhouette was leaning against the brick and mortar of the movie theater. That familiar silhouette, the most comforting safe haven, the greatest tribe member I can possibly imagine. I have to connect the title of my story really quick because I know there's not a lot of time. There's this story, Rumpelstiltskin, where the queen mother is given an impossible task. She needs to spin a whole room of straw into gold. She can't do it alone. It's impossible. So a little sprightly figure shows up and makes a deal with her, and then it happens, only it's not hers. She doesn't own it. It hasn't been integrated into her. It's still an unconscious thing inside of her. But eventually, she learns how to name it, and it's no longer unconscious. It's the most conscious thing, the most beautiful muse one can imagine. So I will name that for you. Anna Rose, May, Ollie, my beloved Tommy, with you all, I can do anything.
So our next storyteller, as I find my spot here, is from California. He first came to Viroqua as a student at Thoreau College 5 years ago, and now he's back in town as a student teacher at Youth Initiative. The title of his story is called Hello from Somewhere. Please welcome Jacob Rowland.
I started learning a foreign language because I wanted to be different. Not different from other people, but different from myself. Different from who I had been up until that point in my life. I think that's the reason anybody tries to learn anything, for transformation. Knowledge transforms the world around you, makes you into a different person, and nothing does that more so than learning a new language. A language is like a kind of film we place on top of the world. It makes things comprehensible. For us, there is no world without words. Maybe some people think there's a distinction between a thing and the name you call it, but for me, you can't pull the two things apart. How strange it can be then to find out that all the things in the world go by an endless number of different names across the world's languages. This isn't something like imagining seeing different colors or something. This is something you can actually experience, sometimes many times over. When you start calling the things around you by different names, that film of language just gets peeled up and something totally different gets laid down. Something like that happened to me when I was very young. I grew up in Los Angeles, and as a kid, when I was a young kid, my parents hired a woman from the neighborhood to be a babysitter. She was a lovely older woman and a devout Catholic, and she only spoke to me in Spanish. And I loved spending time with her, and after a couple weeks, I was a Spanish speaker too. I wasn't speaking English in my head and filling in every word with its Spanish equivalent. I was just speaking the language. And I would still be a Spanish speaker today if I hadn't horrified my Jewish parents every night at dinner when I started thanking Jesus for the food and and asking my parents, had they ever met this Jesus guy? After that, my parents got a different babysitter. And I didn't really think that was fair, and I still don't really think it was fair. I mean, this is the way children understand things. The things you say can't be separated from the way you say them. And it's true the other way around. The life you live in one language is different from the one you might live if you spoke a different one. Learning a new language is something like playing pretend, which is why kids are better at it than adults are. Learning a language as an adult, to be fair, isn't quite so easy. It isn't like peeling up a film and laying down a new one. It's like retiling your bathroom floor. You're dealing with these tiny little things, words and sentences. You're trying to fit them in order, but they keep slipping, or there are gaps, or they're crooked. This thing you're slowly piecing together doesn't feel like a floor you can stand on. I admit, when I started learning German, it wasn't necessarily because I wanted to become a different person. It started with my friend. I was going off to college in Ohio, and he was going to school in Berlin. He told me I should learn German, and then I could come and stay with him for the summer in Berlin. He said, it's just like English, it's so easy, listen. Blut ist dicker als Wasser. It sounds just like English, right? Blood is thicker than water. That's the way it always starts. And so I got to college and I signed up for German 101. And in the first class, the professor started class by holding up his finger and saying, Finger. And holding up his hand and saying, Hand. Now, in any language, it doesn't actually end up being that useful to know the word for finger. What you really need is the stuff that you never even think about. I mean, you never realize how hard it is to sound smart or funny or interesting until you are literally linguistically unable to be those things. So after my first year of German, I did go to Berlin and I stayed with my friend Michael there. And as soon as my daily life started to depend on my ability to express myself in a foreign language, I started looking for hints I could give that I was a halfway intelligent person too, who had thoughts more complex than I am Jacob, I am student, I come learn talking. This was all I could say though, and I grew really depressed at what I saw as my enormous lack of articulateness. I just sort of wandered around tourist kiosks and English bookstores. The phrase books never had the things I wanted to say in them. It's not enough to have words to describe everyday language. You want language for the fantastical, too. You want to be able to say, wow, that squirrel just stole that piece of pizza from that lady, because that's something that's actually worth saying. I wanted a big button that I could walk around with pinned to the front of my shirt that said something like, I'm not an idiot. I just don't know how to say squirrel in your language, and this gives me serious doubts whether it's worth saying anything at all. What are you once you're stripped of your ability to communicate beyond bland everyday language? This was the question I was coming to face with once the novelty of being in a new place had worn off. It became clear to me that this trip had not been about sightseeing. If I hadn't realized that before, I did now. This trip for me was something like a pilgrimage, not speaking of anything dramatic, just the everyday kind of pilgrimages that we all go on in order to become different people, in order to prove that we already have become different people, to leave the places that happen to be our homes for what we feel before we've ever even been there are our real homes. I wanted to belong in this place that for me was the land of books and ideas and culture, and not where I had been born, which for me was the land of television. I wanted so desperately to be a European. I packed every piece of black clothing I owned. I practiced the methodical art of holding a cigarette the way a European does. If anyone had stopped me on the street and put a gun to my head, and the only way to save my life was to give an analysis of the themes in Kafka, well, I was prepared for that situation. Anyway. But once I got to Europe, the only thing that people told me was how American I was. And, you know, I started to think that myself. I was stomping around in my big boots, and it was kind of fun. Being an American didn't seem so bad after all. There were people in Berlin from all over the world, and suddenly I was an American. I had never thought of myself that way. I mean, I was Jacob, I was myself. I was maybe a Californian, but nothing about myself seemed to fit into some kind of American story. But over time, I just accepted it, and I started to like being from where I was from. I got out of my own head. You know, I walked around Berlin. I saw this beautiful city, mostly indifferent to me. I went south and stayed with a family in Bavaria. I lived in their treehouse for a while. And this one week, they took me out into the middle of the country to this festival. It was a Bob Dylan-themed film festival, and they went there every year to meet up with their friends from college. And we stayed for a couple days, and while they were off hanging out with their college friends, I went off on my own, and there wasn't much to do around there but sit around and drink beer, so that's what I did. And this one afternoon, I'm sitting there, and I lock eyes with this guy all the way across the grounds. And he's just got this wild look in his eye. His hair is a crazy mess. He's got a clipboard in his hand, and he's walking really fast towards me. He gets up to me, and he's practically yelling. He's speaking so fast, I still barely understand German. So I get him to slow down, and slowly I start to understand what he's saying. He's saying, "You're late, you're late, you're going on in 5 minutes." And I don't understand what's going on. And I say, "What do you mean I'm, what's happening? What do you mean I'm going on?" And he pauses, and he looks me up and down, and he's like, you are not the Bob Dylan impersonator that I hired?" That's my story, thank you.
Our last storyteller, let me find my place here, was born in 1974 in a hospital in Minnesota and later returned to another hospital in Minnesota. He's had dozens of jobs, including dishwasher, lotion salesman, wilderness guide, and psychotherapist. And now he's here. The title of his story is "While I'm Here." Please welcome Mark Sandberg.
Hello. I'm just going to move this over a little bit. I feel more comfortable walking around. This is the first time I've been to one of these. This is wonderful. Wow, what a delight. It was the turn of the century. I was in my 20s, and I worked at a place called Widgiewagon, Camp Widgiewagon. Some of you may have heard of it. It's in northern Minnesota on the border of Canada, next to the Boundary Waters. And I worked there for about 5 years in doing outdoor education and leading trips, backpacking, canoeing trips, including one of the trips I did was the 9 mile Grand Portage to Lake Superior with wood canvas canoes. And I was feeling good. I was feeling strong. I was over 180 pounds, you know, trying to get ripped and shooting for even more, but I didn't get there. And I felt invincible. And I was living in a beautiful place with beautiful people, and I just really loved it. And I felt great. Until one day, I didn't feel so great. In October of 2000, I started to feel this pain in my stomach. And I thought, it's probably just a virus. I get those sometimes. No big deal. But it got stronger, and it was this pain, this deep pain in the middle of my stomach, right around my belly button. And I had a pretty high pain tolerance, and I thought I could just pull through, and so I just pushed on and just kept going. Another day passed, and wasn't getting any better. And I lived in a cabin with no running water and had an outhouse, but there's some bathrooms that were a little bit farther away, and I was feeling the need to use those instead. So. I was in such pain. I had a baseball bat that I used for a cane because I was in too much pain to not use it. So I was walking slowly down the gravel road of camp to use plumbing, which was nice that it was there. And this went on, like I said, for several days. And finally, I was thinking, man, I got to do something about this. So nowadays, I would just look up. I would diagnose myself using Google, but back then I used the Merck manual. Some of you may know what that is. It's a medical manual. And I also had a wilderness first responder certification, so I had 10 days of training, so I was pretty much a doctor. Anyway, so I looked up what was going on with me, what the symptoms were, And I figured it out. And I thought, okay, I just, you know, I got to figure this out. I'm going to do some things. And may or may not have included some laxatives and some other treatment. And this was not a good idea. That night, I ended up on the bathroom floor of a common space all by myself, alone in a sad, sad old building. And the best word to describe it would be writhing. I was really writhing on the floor in a lot of pain all by myself. And I don't know how long I was there, but much of the night, and I remember feeling or thinking to myself, this is what it feels like to die. And the next day, I woke up, and that pain started to go away. That pain wasn't as strong, and I thought, I did it. I cured myself. I'm good. I wasn't totally out of the woods yet, no pun intended. But it was still, so there was still some sickness there, and I thought, okay, well, it'll pass, it'll pass. Day went by, another day went by, another day went by. And about 5 days later, I thought I'd go get something to eat, because I'd hardly eaten anything. This had been over a week and a half. I'd lost a lot of weight. And I walked into the dining hall, and I looked, and just something about the lights in there, I just felt like, this isn't right. Everything looked really blurry. And I thought, this is not normal. I felt better here, but here, I was starting to feel worse. And so I was encouraged to go see the doctor, and I hadn't wanted to go see the doctor because I didn't have health insurance, and I had a high pain tolerance anyway, like I said. And I didn't have health insurance, and I was making maybe $30 a day, and that was, I didn't want to spend a fortune, like $100, on going to see the doctor. So, but I was finally encouraged to go, and my friend Ryan Savalainen, he drove me because I was incapable of driving myself. And I went to the doctor. He did some palpitations. You know, is that the right word? I don't remember. He squished my stomach with his hand. And it was hard. And he did another exam. I had to turn around. And there was a latex glove. I'll spare details. And that one hurt a lot. I felt an immense amount of pain. And he said, okay, I think I know what's going on. I think you have a ruptured appendix. And the best calculation, looking back, I think it had been about 6 days since I was writhing on the floor, which is, I think that was my appendix rupturing. And then I went another 6 days, and now it looked, using Google now, not Merck manual, I looked up and it's, I forget if there's any doctors in the house, you know, correct me. I think after 4 days, it says it's almost always fatal if your appendix ruptures. Maybe it's 5. But anyway, not good. So he said, you need to have emergency surgery right now. So we didn't have time to go back and get stuff. But we did have time to get gas, going on our way to Virginia, Minnesota, which is about 45 minutes away. While Ryan's pumping the gas, I say, oh, I'm going to call my mom and let her know what's up. So there's a payphone, had a calling card, which I used back then. Called my mom. I said, hey, Mom, I'm going to have emergency surgery in Virginia, Minnesota. And being a mother, she laughed. Yeah, right. I had pranked her so many times throughout my whole life. She was a nurse, and I would call her and pretend I was an old man, saying, like, I need to see somebody. I've got terrible constipation. She couldn't break character. She couldn't pretend. You know, she had to act like it was a real patient. So, because, you know, she didn't want to believe it was me. So it was really fun to mess with her. Anyway, I'd cried wolf too many times, and she didn't believe me until she could hear silence on the other line, and she could tell that I was crying. And she knew it was for real. And she said, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I'll be there tomorrow. She drove up from Iowa. And then I thought, I've got time. I'm going to go talk to my friend Henry across the street. Henry is a belt maker. And don't worry, this is his belt. This is the belt Henry made. I wore it to remember him today. He was a belt maker in Ely next to the Chocolate Moose and Paragus, if you've ever been up there. And he was a great guy. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. But I said, Henry, I'm going to have emergency surgery in Virginia. And he said, okay, I've had surgery before. I got two pieces of advice for you. First, talk to a social worker as soon as you can, because this, if you don't, it's going to get real expensive. And they're going to hook you up with some insurance retroactively. And that was turned out to be a really great piece of advice. And he said, number two, tell them you're allergic to codeine, so they'll give you something stronger. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Henry. Said goodbye. Still had time, I guess. So anyway, we got in the car. We got down to Virginia, Minnesota. Got in the emergency room. They knocked me out with a bunch of drugs and sliced me open. Nowadays, they can do a laparoscopic. If it's not an emergency, it's just a little hole. But I have this 4-inch gash in my, right around here. Sometimes if we're swimming, you know, then I might show you, but I'm not gonna do that right now. Don't worry. I wake up to the sound of a bell. I think it's the Wheel of Fortune. It's not, unfortunately. It's just the sound of the hospital. And then the next thing you know, I'm up in my room, and then I'm out of it. I fall asleep. They've given me this morphine drip. I just like push a button and I get a bunch of morphine. I wake up the next day and my family's there. It's so good to see my mother and my family and friends visiting. And really, I do think that was amazing and really a healing, very, very healing thing to feel all that love. And then the surgeon came in. I really liked him, actually. He was a really nice guy, but he came up to me and he said, I'd like to speak with Mark alone here for a minute. I think he didn't want my mother to hear this. So he shut the door and he walks up to me and he says, you should have died. It sounded kind of awkward, but he really wanted me to understand that it was really unlikely that I had survived. He said, if I was in your shoes, I wouldn't have made it. He said, I think the only reason you made it was because you were physically fit and your body could take a hit. And you're really lucky to be here. And that really hit me. I knew it was serious, but I really knew it was even more so at that point. And like I said, I was on morphine, so I wasn't seeing things clearly. And I looked at my chart and I see the word colostomy, and I thought, oh no, I know I've got tubes coming out of me and I don't know what's going on down there, but a colostomy bag, oh man. I thought, of course I have one. I have a scatological sense of humor and I make fun of everything scatological, including colostomy bags, so forgive me, but I thought, of course I'll have one of those, but that's okay. I'm really just glad, you know, I'm thankful to be alive and I'll take it, whatever. But the nurse looked at it and she said, no, that says colectomy. Oh, okay, no big deal. That just means they took a piece of my colon out because it was dead. Okay, but don't worry, if you're wondering, everything works fine in that area, all good. So I did not have a colostomy and I was very thankful, although I was ready and fully prepared to have one for the rest of my life. Also, I took inventory of what was going on for me. Like I said, I had a big gash here, and it was oozing. It could not be sewn up fully. It was, or maybe at all, because there was so much infection in my body. It had to be left open for weeks. And my skin was yellow, and my eyes were yellow. I was jaundice, and it was a severe systemic infection. I lost maybe 40 pounds. I was really thin and still kind of hunched over. And I remember the nurse asked me if I wanted, you know, it was time to take a shower. And she was so sweet. I really liked her, and she was, what a wonderful person. And I was thinking, I don't think you really want to see me, you know, because she said, I can help you if you need help. If you don't think you can stand up, and you know, you can do this whole thing. And I was like, I look like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons with a wound. Flesh wound, right? I don't think you want to see that. So I think I can do it on my own. So I was in the hospital for 10 days because the infection was so severe. But so during that 10 days, I remember walking around the hospital. Somebody had given me a magazine, a Life magazine, of famous expeditions throughout history, and I was so inspired by that, and I just really wanted to get back into the woods, you know, get back in the wilderness and lead trips. And I remember walking in, you know, a really pathetic gown. You know, it was like humiliating, but walking down the hall with my IV stand, just thinking, wow, I am so thankful to be here. I never want to take this body for granted ever again. And just I was amazed that I still had this ability to smell, to taste, to feel, to move. And I was able to walk, and I was alive. And at that moment, I thought to myself, I want to appreciate my life and this body as much as I can while I'm here. Thank you.
Well, gosh, all Friday, we're done now. Oh, what a great night of storytelling. Thank you for making almost dying kind of hilarious in a way. But thank you again, all you speakers. Let me first start with some thank yous. Lisa, Jamila Wirth, Amy Arnold, Casey Grissom, Denise Simanchin, and Margaret Lenars. They were our committee putting all this wonderfulness together. So let's hear it for them. Let's not forget all the wonderful volunteers. They're probably out there listening, or maybe they're standing against the wall, but all the kids out there selling the concessions and the setup crews, the cleanup crews, everybody that helped. Let's hear it for them too as well. Obviously, again, thank you all for being here. For one of the biggest fundraisers and supporting this awesome event. And most of all, thank you to all the speakers, the storytellers. Man, it was a great evening of stories. Thank you so much for everything that that you shared with us. Have a wonderful evening. Thanks again for coming, and we'll see you next year. Have a great weekend. Thank you.